I was born in a small town called Masjid Suleiman in southern Iran.
I was born in Syria.
I was born in Hamburg, Germany.
I was born in Kuwait.
I was born in Tanzania in a refugee camp.
I was born in Singapore.
Guatemala.
I'm from Ireland.
I was born in Thailand refugee
camp. I was born in Mumbai.
I was born in Vientiane, Laos.
I was born in England.
I was born in Costa Rica.
Welcome to Many Roads to Here, bringing the voices of immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers to a national conversation about migration and identity. I'm Halima Shah. Today, you're going to hear from 38-year-old Mohsin Jamal. He is from Afghanistan's Hazara community. They're an ethnic minority and mostly Shia Muslim. They've faced discrimination for centuries, and each time power changes hands in Afghanistan, there are new fears of persecution and displacement for Hazaras. As a child born in the 80s, Mohsin witnessed Afghanistan torn apart by conflict more than once. He had to flee to safety more than once. He figured out how to survive in a new country more than once. And he managed to do it all thanks to a quick mind, nimble hands, and a deep connection to his Hazara community. His story begins in Kabul.
I was born in 1986 in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. My father had his own store, and it was in a crowded area in the market, and he sold rice there. So my father had a good business. So, you know, every day that he would return back home, he would bring a lot of money in parcels, and he would just empty them as if you're emptying, you know, clothes out of a basket. So throwing all the money on the floor in the room. And, you know, my siblings, my sisters, brothers, and I would sit there and count the money and put 20s one side, 50s one side, 10s one side, 100s one side, and then count how much money they had earned at the store that day. So that was how, you know, I learned how to count, and not only me, my siblings.
Mohsin's family was wealthier than most in his neighborhood, but that didn't spare them from discrimination because of their ethnicity.
When we talk about Hazaras in Afghanistan, there is always a word coming to everyone's mind, and that's persecution. Because Hazaras have been persecuted for centuries in Afghanistan, particularly in the 1800s. It is believed that 62% of our people were either killed or sold as slaves, and their girls were forcefully married to men of other communities in Afghanistan, or they were sold as slaves to foreign countries. So at home, we spoke our own, you know, dialect, which is Hazaragi. It's also a dialect of Dari. But as soon as we, you know, got out of our home, we had to speak in a Kabuli accent. Otherwise, you know, people would say, oh, you're, you know, Kulfakchapat, flood noses. They would also call us Mushkhur, which is rat eaters. But we never eat rats in Afghanistan. So, you know, just to discriminate against us.
As a Hazara child growing up in the 1980s, Mohsin still describes his early years as good ones. His father had a lot of customers, the family owned a car, the kids had nice clothes. But it was a tumultuous time in Afghanistan. The country's Soviet-backed government was unpopular. And by the time Mohsin was five, a group of Islamist fighters known as the Mujahideen were close to toppling the communist government. There was turmoil in the streets. And soon, at home. Because Mohsin's father fell ill and died, leaving his mother widowed with 9 kids.
My mother was a strong woman. She, you know, helped us a lot after that, you know, to become stable again. But because the culture is different there, everybody would see that if you lose your father, it means you lose everything. So that influence was there in my mind that, okay, what will happen to us after this? So therefore, we were very quiet, still mourning our father. It wasn't even a year after my father passed away. Suddenly, helicopters started hovering and just announcing on their mics, the country is free, stay in your houses, don't loot anything, and we are an Islamic country now. I remember we went to our school and there were those, you know, scary-looking men standing there with long hair, guns in their hands, and their clothes, their hair, their beards, they were so long and very dirty. They told us, yeah, this school is closed. This is our base now, military base. Go to the other school. So there was another school nearby. We went there. And when we went there, it was interesting because we didn't see our female teachers.
Kabul was changing under the Mujahideen, especially for women. But the group's control didn't last long. Its alliance splintered, and the city was caught in crossfire between rival militias. Amid all of that, the family still had to run their rice shop. It was now managed by Mohsen's mother and staffed by her children, including 6-year-old Mohsen, who quickly realized his family needed more ways to make money.
I was one of the shopkeepers there because in the mornings, I usually stayed in the shop. In the afternoons, it was my brother staying in the shop because in the afternoons, I would go to school. In the mornings, he would go to school. So I was in second grade, I think, around that time. And I was a shopkeeper, you know, running the shop. It was only me running the shop. No one else was there to, you know, deal with the customers and do customer service. My neighbor, there was a shop next to my shop, and his sons and daughters were waving carpet in their homes. And he was like, hey, Mohsen, close the shop and go to my home and learn how to wave carpet. And I was like, no, I have to run the shop because if I close it, then we will not have enough income for our family. And he was like, no, if you wave carpet, you will have more income than this shop. And he somehow convinced me to close the shop and go to his home and wave carpet. I learned it very easily, and because I knew counting and carpet, you know, waving is a lot of counting, and there is a map, you have to follow the map. And so therefore, it was very easy to learn for me. Then after a few months, I became a master in carpet. Then I found a carpet factory close to our house, and my income was more than anyone in my family.
As Mohsen and his family worked in Kabul, a new insurgency was forming and gaining territory in the south of Afghanistan, the Taliban. By the time Mohsen was 10, they had marched north and seized control of Kabul. Afghanistan once again changed hands, and Hazaras once again feared for their safety.
As soon as they captured Kabul, they started, you know, persecuting us. Every night we would hear somebody was taken from our neighborhood, and they were beaten in their bases, and they would drop the corpses back the next day in front of their houses. So they would come, climb over the walls into the houses and, you know, wake everyone up and say, okay, the females should just go to the other room, and all the male members tying their hands with their rope or pieces of clothes, and they were also tying their eyes, and they would put them on the back of pickup trucks and take them to the military bases they had. So they would start beating them, and they would also tell their family to bring money and bring weapons. Weapons and money, weapons and money. If you don't have weapons, buy weapons.
Hazara men and boys were being targeted. Mohsen's eldest brothers had already fled the country, but his mother decided it was time for her younger ones to leave too. She sent Mohsen across the border to Pakistan with his 16-year-old brother.
I remember the day, it was at 3 a.m. in the morning. It was very dark. My mother woke up us and said, okay, the van would come soon, go. And my brother and I took a bag, and we got on the van and went to the east gate of Kabul. Across all, you know, gates of Kabul, Taliban had checkpoints, and they were very seriously checking all the people going out or coming in. So when our cars arrived, they noticed that my brother is different from others facially because he's a Hazara, and asked him to get out of our van. Then I got out with him. And the Taliban said, okay, find your bag. My brother just took his bag from the back of the van, and then they said, open the bag. My brother opened the bag, and there was a green sleeping bag we had. When the Taliban saw that, they said, okay, this is a military sleeping bag. Were you in the army? Were you in the militia groups in the past? And my brother was like, no, look at my age. I'm just 16 years old. They were like, no, you must be part of the militia or in the army. My father had a lot of customers who were in the military. So they were gifting him something in the past. So I think that bag also was a gift from them to my father. It didn't mean anything to us except a sleeping bag. But for them, it was very different. So they started beating my brother with a rifle. Then I still remember the face of the commander. Very scary, very serious beard and dark hair, as I could see from the around the turban, and dark eyebrows. There was a soldier next to him and he had a gun. This is exactly what he said. Stay here, I'll talk to you later. And he went to check the other van. And they walked to the other van, and it was then when the driver was pointing to us to look at him. He was asking us to run to the other side of the checkpoint, and he would wait there to pick us up. It was not because he felt, you know, that we should be saved. It was because if we had not gone back to the van, he would lose two passengers who would not give him money. And we ran, and we didn't look back. Our van was waiting there, and we got back into the van, and we left and crossed the border. And we went to Peshawar. They got another van to another area which is close to Peshawar, and it's called Attak Kamalpur. And when we went there, I saw a lot of people from our neighborhood there, a lot of them.
There were other Hazaras, people who'd been disappearing from Kabul because they were fleeing to Pakistan and finding work as carpet weavers. Mohsen and his brother did the same, working and living in a carpet factory to support their family.
In the factory, this is our, you know, our carpet that we are working at, and at night we would sleep next to the carpet. Everybody would do the same thing. We had, you know, a kitchen, and we had a cook there, and we would pay for the cook every month, and he would cook food for all the people living in that factory. There are a lot of other children as well, so even there are children younger than me in that factory. So I was 10, so we had children who were 8 or who were even 6. They had been working in the same factory with us. So all of us kids would play together every evening after we were done with the carpet. We stayed there for 2 years. Then my brother was able to go to Kabul and bring my family. He took all my family members and came back to Pakistan.
With their mother and siblings now in Pakistan, life started to get a little easier. They settled into a new city, and Mohsen was able to return to school.
It was 1998 when we moved to Quetta, in southwestern Pakistan. So in the neighborhood I lived is called Hazara Town. It was very good for us because we would feel like we are at home, because nobody would discriminate against us and nobody would say, oh, you're flat noses or you're this, you're that. And there we stayed for 7 years, and I went to school there. I learned English there. I would work on the carpet from 6 a.m. to 12. And from 12, I would take lunch and run towards the school. From 1 to 5, I was at school. Then from 5, I would go back home and change my clothes, put my bag and all the books. And I would take my notebook and other book, English book, and run towards my English language class.
Mohsen liked his life in Pakistan's Hazara town. He had family, friends, work, school. And by the time he was 19, Mohsen had an advanced English diploma. But he still missed home. And Kabul was now under U.S. occupation, run by a new Afghan government that guaranteed Hazara's constitutional rights. So Mohsen and his family decided to go back.
The first day we entered Kabul from West Gate of Kabul, it was very dusty. Roads were unpaved, a lot of roads were unpaved, and there were a lot of cars, a lot of carts that sell fruits and vegetables, all of that, on the road. It was too crowded and very polluted. As soon as I arrived there, I started teaching English at English educational centers in Kabul. In the meantime, I started going back to school. So in 2012, I graduated from the university. Then I went to join the biggest news channel in Afghanistan, which is Tulu News. I was also making reports here. For me, it was dangerous. One of my brothers lived in Ghazni province in 2010 to 2014 that I was on TV. He was there and he was telling me that the Taliban, you know, have increased their presence here and they'll know you. They know that you belong to my family. They'll kill you if you come here. So therefore, I was like, okay, it's too dangerous to be on TV then. it's better to just quit it. Then I quit it, went to do my master's and came back and didn't go back to the media. But I started working with Americans here. It was also media work for a company that was contracted by the U.S. Defense Department. If you work for 2 years with Americans in Afghanistan, you would be eligible to apply for an SIV, a special immigrant visa.
Mohsen applied for the SIV because, like so many other Afghans, he could see the writing on the wall. The U.S. wanted to pull out of its 20-year war in Afghanistan, and the Taliban were sure to come back. When they did, they would likely retaliate against people who worked with the U.S., like Mohsen, who is now a husband and a father of three. He was hopeful that he'd be able to go to the U.S. with his family, because their SIV application was under review. But before they could get on a plane out of Kabul, the city fell back into Taliban hands.
A lot of provinces, a lot of villages had already fallen to the Taliban, so everyone knew that the Taliban would capture Kabul very soon, but we didn't know that it would happen on 15 August. So in the evening, the Taliban entered Kabul. One of my colleagues, we had a group, WhatsApp group, he just sent a message that, take care of yourselves, the Taliban are after us. Then I sent my wife and my kids to my wife's family, and I started moving from one friend's house to another one to, you know, to stay safe.
With the Taliban back in the city, Kabul was in chaos. The airport was now an embassy teeming with people desperate to escape. The streets were crowded with cars, packed with entire families and their possessions. The ATMs were out of cash. With a target on his back, Mohsen was in hiding. And then he got a text that gave him hope.
The American I was working with for 4 years, he sent us a group message saying that we should be at the east gate of Kabul airport at 5:30 p.m. because our point of contact would be there. He would let us in to get on a plane and go out of the country. That day I was very nervous. I didn't want to go. So I was the last person who moved towards the airport because I had heard a lot of news that there will be explosion at the east gate of Kabul today. There are a lot of reports on social media about it. And finally, when my colleague said, hey, Mohsen, you're the only one who is left behind, so please come on time, don't be late. Then I was like, okay. So I called my brother and said, can you get a taxi for my family? Send them, I'm here. And they came and I got on the taxi and went to the east gate of Kabul. We were about 5 minutes walk away. Then there was a boom, big explosion. There was a suicide bomber blowing himself up among all the people who were waiting at the gate to get in to the airport. Around 200 people were killed. That is how it was reported. Then we saw a lot of bodies being taken on the wheelbarrows, on the shoulders of the people. They were taking dead bodies or injured people. Then I had to close my kids' eyes. And also I told my wife to help me with that because I had three kids, to close their eyes so that they should not see the blood or the dead bodies or those injured around us. Then I asked the taxi driver to turn back and go back home.
That was one of many attempts to leave the country. Mohsen looked for ways to fly out of Kabul, but security threats kept endangering his family's exit route. Then he got a message telling him to take a different route, one out of Mazar-e-Sharif, a city north of Kabul where a charter flight was waiting.
We got on a bus and we got 5 passports for all 5 of us, my 3 kids, my wife and I, and 1 backpack for all 5 of us. We went to the airport there. We went past the first checking point at the airport, and we were waiting for the in the middle to go through the second checking point. But the Taliban commander came and said, hey, the flight is canceled, go back home.
They had no home to go to in Mazar-e-Sharif. They were just moving around the city, trying to avoid being recognized. It felt like time was running out. And the longer Mohsen and his family stayed, the more danger they were in. But 3 days later, he got another message.
At midnight, my supervisor texted us, hey, there's a plane, your plane leaving tomorrow morning, go to the airport. Then in the morning again, we went to the airport and we passed all the checkpoints there and we got on the plane. As soon as we were there, the Taliban fighters came on the plane. All of us could hardly breathe, you know. Everybody was silent and afraid, what's going on here? Why are they on the plane now? They were asking for one of my colleagues, and they were naming him, saying, where is he? Fortunately, he was not on the plane. They walked to the end, came back, walked to the end, came back. And they couldn't find them, and they got off the plane. And then the plane taxied down the runway. We left Mazar-i-Sharif Airport. As soon as we crossed the border and went to Iranian airspace, then we were relieved. Then we arrived in Abu Dhabi. For 7 months, we stayed in a refugee camp in Abu Dhabi.
It was the peak of COVID, and there was lots of paperwork to process. They weren't going to get into the U.S. quickly. But when they did, the family finally got their shot at a new beginning in Salem, Oregon.
So now I work at Salem for Refugees as an employment coordinator. I help other refugees like me to settle here in Salem, Oregon, and also help them find employment here. You know, for women in Afghanistan nowadays, they don't have a right to go to school, to go even out of their homes alone without a male companion. But here my wife has got a driver's license. You know, it's a pride for my family. And she's also attending English classes. It was about 10 days ago I saw her teacher, and she was so happy because she was like, today I communicated with her in English all 1 hour. I was so happy for that. And I hope that, yeah, she'll soon be able to communicate easily with everyone in the community there. And my sons, yeah, the oldest son I have is in the third grade right now. And his teacher last year, when he was in the second grade, told me that he is translating for other Afghan students who come to his class. My second son just went to the first grade this year, and his English is also really good. And my youngest son, he's very funny because he goes to Head Start. It's been the third year he goes to Head Start, because some of the teachers there speak Spanish sometimes, teach them, you know, some Spanish songs, some Spanish words, and counting in Spanish. He is very funny because when we play hide and seek in our home, it's the rule that everybody would speak Hazaragi, and the counting would happen in Dari. But he counts sometimes in Spanish when we do hide and seek. I say, okay, could you please count in Dari? And he's like, isn't it Dari? I said, no, it's not Dari, it's Spanish. Then he starts counting in English. I say, can you count in Dari? And he says, it's Dari. I said, no, it's not Dari, it's English. Then he starts counting in Dari one or two, then says, is it Dari? I say, yes.
Mohsen's sons speak multiple languages and are making their way in a new country, just like their father did. But in many ways, Mohsen's childhood couldn't be more different than his son's.
My oldest son is now 8 years old. He will become 9 just in 20 days. When I was 6, I was working, you know, as a carpet weaver, and also I was a shopkeeper. And I was fleeing for safety from the Taliban. I'm so happy for them because their lives are very different than mine. They live in a better country right now. They know that they will have equal rights with anyone else here. They can also go freely anywhere they want. You know, even going out of Kabul was dangerous for us then, because we could not move freely around. Whatever I do, my wife does, it's only for our kids, because we have been through challenges, we have been through a lot of sufferings in our lives. We don't want them to face the same thing. So we hope that they will, you know, enjoy their lives, and they will study in the best universities, and they will make right decisions for their future without others telling them what to do, what not to do.
Many Roads to Here is a production of The Immigrant Story. This episode was produced, edited, and hosted by me, Halima Shah. Audio post-production was done by Greg Palmer, and the original interview was conducted by Sankar Raman in the fall of 2024. Thank you to St. Andrew Lutheran Church in Beaverton for the use of their space to record the interview. This episode is a part of a series exploring the stories and experiences of Asian Americans. It's produced as part of the Oregon Rises Above Hate Coalition and made possible by a generous contribution by Anne Naito Campbell. To learn more about the Oregon Rises Above Hate Coalition, please visit OregonRisesAboveHate.com. For more stories, visit theimmigrantstory.org/manyroads. Listen live at prp.fm or stream us wherever you get your podcasts.